Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So here we go with the 27th sutta in the collection of the Middle Length Sayings, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint. So for those who are just coming in, there is still some sheets available there. For those who wish to get a sheet on the shorter discourse of the elephant's footprint. Still a couple more people coming in. Okay, so it's number 27, sutta number 27, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint. Wow, our clock must be going fast, or people are very slow. Here we go, anyway. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, a Brahmin, Janusoni, was driving out of Sarvati, which was close to the Jeta Grove, maybe only a couple of kilometers away, in the middle of the day, in an all-white chariot drawn by white mares. So that means he's a very wealthy man. And that's like having a sort of a white Rolls or a limo. He saw the wanderer, Pilotika. Wanderer was another type of religious person in the time of the Buddha. Not Buddhists, but people who had left their home wandering in search of wisdom. So he saw the wanderer, Pilotika, coming in the distance and asked him, "Now, where is Master Wachayana?" Wachayana was his clan. "Where is the master coming from in the middle of the day?" Those who just come in, sutta number 27, we've still got some sheets on the table over there. If you wish to get a couple of sheets, I'm glad there's more Sri Lankans here because we're discussing the very first teaching which Mahinda gave when he went to Sri Lanka in honor of my recent visit. So number 27, if you got that on your book. So, the Brahmin Janusoni was asking this wandering, "Where are you coming from?" And he replied, "Sir, I am coming from the presence of the recluse Gotama." Sometimes they actually called him that. Recluse is Samana, of which we get the Shraman. It's from the Samana Gotama. "What does Master Wachayana think of the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? Is the Buddha wise or not?" And Vachayana, the wanderer, replies, "Sir, who am I to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? One would surely have to be his equal to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom." "Ooh, Master Vachayana praises the recluse Gotama with high praise indeed." "Sir, who am I to praise the recluse Gotama? The recluse Gotama is praised by the praised as best amongst gods and humans. What reason does Master Vachayana see that he has such confidence in the Buddha, in the recluse Gotama?" So here we get the first simile of the elephant's footprint, but this is Master Vachayana's, the wanderer's simile. "Sir, suppose a wise elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood and were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. He would come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. So too, when I saw four footprints of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed. by the Blessed One, and the Sangha is practicing the good way. And do you know what those words are? The Buddha is fully enlightened. That's where it said, the Blessed One, Bhagava Sambuddho, the Suakata Dhamma and Supatipano Sangha. Sometimes we chant that very often. So what are the four signs? And here, this is not so profound, but this introduces something which is coming up later on. Sir, I have seen here certain learned nobles. This is a Katiya clan, this is the warrior clan, who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, as sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. They wander about, as it were, demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. When they hear the recluse Gotama will visit such and such a village or town, they formulate a question thus. We will go to the recluse Gotama and ask him this question. If he is asked like this, he will answer like that, and so we will refute his doctrine in this way. And he is asked like that, he will answer like that, and so we will refute his doctrine in that way. So that they prepare to demolish his doctrines with clever questions. They hear, the recluse Gotama has come to visit such and such a village or town, and they go to the recluse Gotama. And the recluse Gotama instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages them with a talk on the Dhamma. After they have been instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged by the recluse Gotama with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question. So how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they became his disciples. When I saw this first footprint of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha is practicing the good way. That was the first footprint. And the second footprint, I have seen certain learned Brahmins who were clever, etc. And they tried to formulate a question to refute the Buddha. Instead, they heard the Dhamma, and at the end of the discourse, they too became his disciples. And the same with learned householders. And also, the fourth, learned recluses, who were clever. And they asked the question, they thought they were going to ask a question, they never did. Instead, they listened to the Dhamma, and they were so impressed that they became followers, and they more than followers, they do not so much as ask him the question, so how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they asked the recluse Gotama to allow them to go forth from the home life into homelessness. And he gives them the going forth. So you've got the nobles, the Brahmins and the householders, and the recluses. The only difference is when the recluses get converted, they want to become monks themselves. So the Buddha gives them the going forth, and not long after they've gone forth, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they in this very life enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. In other words, they become arahats. They say thus, we were very nearly lost. We were very nearly perished. For formerly we claimed that we were recluses, though we were not really recluses. We claimed that we were Brahmins, though we're not really Brahmins. We claimed even that we were arahats, though we're not really arahats. But now we are recluses, Brahmins, we are arahats. When I saw this fourth footprint of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. When I saw these four footprints of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha is practicing the good way. So there we have this wanderer who was very impressed by even people trying to refute the Buddha's teachings from all different parts of society. They ended up becoming his followers. And if they were members of other religions, recluses or whatever, they ended up becoming Buddhist monks or nuns. So those were the four footprints he saw. So before we go any further, any questions on that? or comments on that? At that time, there were many people claiming to be arahats. The word arahat was well known. Because what an arahat means, be a worthy one. That's its literal meaning. Like a very worthy one. So that's what the word actually meant. So many people claimed they were worthy and they reached the goal, whatever that goal fully was. And so that was the one of the words which was used by the Buddha to signify a person who was fully enlightened. You can even see here that they said, before we thought we were recluses, fine, we thought we were Brahmins. We had a Brahmin of the caste. We also had the idea in religious life, like a Brahmin, like a holy one. Not holy because your parents were holy, that you were in some religious lineage, like the Brahmin caste, but using the idea of a Brahmin as a holy one, as a spiritual person, by virtue of your understanding, by your practice, by your wisdom, rather than just by your birth. Also, that meaning of the word Brahmin was there in the time of the Buddha. So you see, in many cases, especially in places like the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, you're not a Brahmin because your parents were Brahmins. The original idea of a Brahmin would be like a priest or a spiritual person. You're not a spiritual person as a sort of caste. You're a spiritual person because of how you behave. So these are words which were obviously being used in the time of the Buddha and had like sometimes a double meaning. Okay. When this was said, the Brahmin Janusoni got down from his all-white chariot, drawn by white mares, and arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation to the Blessed One, and uttered the exclamation three times, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Hand of the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. That's it, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. What you got here? Hand of the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. So, you know, those words we say are actually coming from the earliest historical documents. And then afterwards, after saying Namo Tassa three times, Janusoni the Brahmin said, perhaps some time or other we might meet Master Gotama and have some conversation with him. So Janusoni, white chariot, white mares, was obviously a very wealthy man, a very high up in that society of the time, and he was obviously very impressed with the Buddha, even though he hadn't met him yet. So that's almost the prologue. And now later on we find Janusoni coming to meet the Buddha and actually recounting that conversation he had. And the Buddha said what the real footprints of a Buddha are. Because just you may go to any teacher, just because they've got lots of disciples, and just because people come and they join the community, it does not mean that they're enlightened or they're wise or compassionate. Because, you know, sometimes there's mega churches or mega mosques. I don't think this actually counts as a mega Buddhist temple yet, but we're working on it. No, I'm not. But you can understand, just because you've got lots of followers doesn't mean the teachings are correct. So you see, the Vajrayana's idea that just because many people join as disciples of the Buddha's surely going to say, that doesn't always mean that it's a good teaching. So he said, there's something more important than that. And what the real footprints of an elephant, what the real signs of a good teacher truly are. And this is coming next. Then the Brahmin Janusoni went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. In the suttas, exchanging greetings means you're not a disciple yet. You're just being respectful. So he hasn't actually worshipped the Buddha yet. He's just exchanging greetings. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and related to the Blessed One his entire conversation with the wanderer Pilotika. Thereupon the Blessed One, the Buddha, told him, at this point, Brahmin, the simile of the elephant's footprint has not yet been completed in detail. As to how it is completed in detail, listen and attend carefully to what I shall say. "Yes, sir," the Brahmin Jonasoni replied. And the Blessed One said this: "Brahmin, suppose an elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood and were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are many she-elephants that leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have prominent teeth and leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up, and marks made by tusks. A wise elephant woodsman would still not come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have tusks and leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up, and marks made by tusks and broken off branches. And he sees that bull elephant at the root of a tree or in the open, walking about, sitting or lying down, and then he comes to the conclusion, this is that big bull elephant." So I'm going to interpret that story a little bit here, just so it makes sense with what comes afterwards. So just seeing the signs of like a big bull elephant doesn't mean it really is one. You've got to actually see the bull elephant with your own eyes. In the same way, you might go to a teacher, a guru, a master, or any other religion, and sometimes people just get confused just by the signs. They've got a big church. They may even speak very eloquently. They may have charisma, but they have many disciples. That doesn't mean that they are a worthy teacher, that they know what they're talking about. You've got to actually see that bull elephant. Experience it yourself, which is what's coming next. And soon you'll see the only way that you know that this is the Buddha is actually to see what the Buddha saw. And then you understand that, yes, this is the right teaching for you. So let's go forward further. "So too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata," a Tathagata means a thus God. It's how the Buddha always referred to himself. He never said I, he never called himself Buddha, he always called himself the Tathagata. The other people would call him Bhagava, the Blessed One, if they were disciples, or the recluse Gotama, if they were just associates and not real disciples. So the Tathagata was how the Buddha called himself. Literally means, thus gone. "Here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct." It's really important to pause on that. That a real Buddha is not just perfect in knowledge, but perfect in conduct as well. It's not just what you know, but how that translates into your behavior, which marks a true teacher. So sometimes you may get some teachers who are very, very wise, but their private life leaves much to be desired. So it has to be true knowledge and conduct. "Sublime knower of the worlds," which means the three worlds, of the world of the five senses, plus the worlds of the jhanas. That's the Karmaloka, Rupaloka, and Arupaloka. "Incomparable leader of persons to be tamed." Some people just will not be tamed, even if you're a Buddha. You can only train those people who are able to be tamed. The Buddha is acknowledging that even the most powerful Buddha sometimes cannot train some people. "Teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. And sometimes you know that I'm sometimes a cheeky monk, and I use this particular saying here, teachers of gods and humans, if any ever get like these Pentecostals who come up to me and say, ah, your Buddha, he wasn't even a prophet, and he's not divine. And I say, yeah, it's right. You know, the Buddha wasn't a prophet, he wasn't divine, but he was a teacher of gods and men. So our Buddha was a teacher of your Jesus' father. That's just being cheeky. I only do that if people are cheeky to me. Anyway, he declares this world with its gods, its Maras and Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins and princes and its peoples, which he himself has realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dharma good in the beginning, in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly, utterly perfect and pure. And a householder or householder's son or daughter or one born in some other clan hears the Dharma. On hearing the Dharma, they acquire faith in the Buddha. Possessing that faith, they consider thus, household life is crowded and dusty. Actually, the real words, instead of crowded and dusty, the word crowded means like oppressive. And dusty literally means is a rubbish dump. So when it says, there's a Raja, the word here in Pali is Rajapata. So it's actually quite so derogatory. He said like household life is like living in a tip. I thought I'd mention that to you. That's what it actually says, is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished conch shell. That was one of the things we would use, with a used to, a familiar item, and a shell, a conch shell was very highly polished, so it's so pure and faultless. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth in the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relatives, they do shave off their hair and beard, if they got one, put on the yellow robe and go forth from home life into homelessness. Having thus gone forth and possessing the monk's training and way of life, they abandon the killing of living beings, and they abstain from killing living beings. With rod, with actually club and knife laid aside, gentle, well-behaved and kindly, they abide compassionate to all living beings. So this is giving some of the idea of the monk's way of life. They're not just put aside killing, they also put aside rods and clubs and weapons. And instead they're gentle and kindly. The traditional idea you have of what a monk or a nun really is. Gentle and kindly, they don't go around with a stick hitting you. They're compassionate to all living beings. They abandon the taking of what is not given. They abstain from taking what's not given, taking only what is given, and also expecting only what is given. And by not stealing, they abide in purity. I particularly like that phrase, expecting only what is given. In other words, a good monk doesn't go around asking for things or insinuating for things, saying, oh, you know, this robe is getting very sort of torn and very old. It would be very good if I got a new robe, especially one made of this particular material. You don't insinuate. You just expect what's given to you. So if you don't get a new robe, you just patch it. I'm not asking for a new robe. We've got heaps and heaps and heaps of robes. This is just an example of what a bad monk does. So you can understand, we expect only what comes to us. We don't sort of try and manipulate to get what we want. And that's a good monk. Abandoning in celibacy, you observe, celibacy, living apart and abstaining from the practice of sexual intercourse. It's not just saying, okay, I'm not going to have sexual intercourse, I'm not going to have any sex or any romance. It's important that monks and nuns actually live apart from the opposite gender. which is why that we have a monk's monastery down at Serpentine and a nun's monastery up in Gidgee-Gannop. And there are the separation of the genders, because you see here, the idea is like living apart, separate genders. Abandoning false speech, you abstain from false speech. You speak the truth, adhere to the truth, is trustworthy and reliable. One who's not a deceiver of the world. That also includes if you say you're going to come to a certain place at a certain time, you know, you keep those promises. You know, you're trustworthy and reliable. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. Which is sometimes why when you ask a monk, oh, can you come to this house at a certain time, sometimes you can't just say yes. Because if I say yes and receive an invitation, I am going to really, really try hard to get there. Because that idea of keeping your promises and being reliable was drummed into me by Ajahn Chah. So if we say we're not sure yet, it means that maybe people in the world might just say yes very easily, but monks and nuns will not say yes easily unless they really know they can make it. And he's no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech. They abstain from malicious speech. And this is what malicious speech means here. I call this malicious gossip. You do not repeat elsewhere what you have heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor do you repeat to these people what you've heard elsewhere in order to divide those people. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, and delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. So this malicious gossip, you can see, it's a sort of speech which you use, you know, to create factions. The sort of speech which sometimes people call office politics, or like community politics. You know, where you try and repeat some words to, you know, suck up to somebody in power and to divide other people. That's called the malicious gossip. So you refrain from that. And you're one who promotes friendships and enjoys harmony. So you're someone who tries to create as much harmony as possible. And abandoning harsh speech. You abstain from harsh speaks. You speak such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Which is, you don't call anyone a stupid pig. You don't shout at your stupid disciples. You don't say, you're such a dumb disciple. Why have I been labored by having you as one of my disciples? Oh. So you don't get sort of into that harsh speech and call people names or shout at people. And that, somebody asked that the other day. Is it allowable for monks to actually to shout and get angry at others, just as a teaching practice? In all the years which I've been a monk, I've seen some monks try that, but it never works. And those people who do shout and scold, I compare it to what the Buddha said here, and that's not really how a monk or a nun should speak. Instead, we should speak such words as are gentle, pleasing, lovable, as go to the heart, courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to the many. Abandoning gossip. You abstain from gossip. You speak at the right time. In other words, not speak too much. Speak what is fact. Speaks on what is good, speaks the Dharma, the discipline. At the right time, you speak such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Or, as one of the talks in Sri Lanka said, to speak only if you can improve upon the silence. So if you can't improve upon the silence, then be quiet. And that's actually for all people there. That's the summary of the third factor of the Eightfold Path, right speech. This is also for monks and nuns. You abstain from injuring seeds and plants. You practice eating only in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time, which is the afternoon. As a monk or a nun, you abstain from dancing and singing, which is a very good job because monks like me certainly can't sing, and I would hate to see me trying to dance. Music, so you don't listen to rock music. And theatrical shows, like just watching a movie or watching something on the TV. So you abstain from shows. You abstain from wearing garlands, smartening yourself up with scent, and embellishing yourself with unguents, in other words, makeup. You abstain from, well, he has high and large couches. You know, that's one of the eight precepts. That is the idiom which means luxurious furnishings. You abstain from accepting gold and silver means golden money. So already you see here that what the Buddhas say, a person who's gone forth should not take any money. Also, you don't have like food supplies. So you abstain from accepting raw grain, raw meat, accepting women and girls. You don't have a harem if you're a monk. You abstain from accepting men and women slaves. You abstain from accepting goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares. All cats and dogs, so please don't leave any more cats in our monastery. You abstain from accepting fields and land. You abstain from going on errands and running messages. You abstain from buying and selling. You abstain from false weights, false metals and false measures, in other words, being a crook. You abstain from cheating, deceiving, defrauding and trickery. You abstain from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder and violence. And this is such a basic morality for a monk, which many of you expect for a monk, even if you're not a Buddhist. You expect monks and nuns to have at least that degree of restraint. And now we come to the simplicity part. You become content with robes to protect your body, with alms food to maintain your stomach. And wherever you go, you set out taking only these with you, just your robes and bowl. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body, with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. These days you also need passport. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, you experience within yourself a bliss that is blameless. I'll pause here because this is the virtue of a good monk, or a virtue of a person who knows about simplicity. And I hope you can understand that this is describing just the essence of a monk or a nun, what they're really supposed to do, how they're supposed to live. And a person who does keep those types of precepts, there is a payoff in this life. You experience a bliss of blamelessness. So in other words, you look at your conduct and you've done nothing which is liable to criticism or which is which is open being rebuked by those wise people in the world. So you have this beautiful feeling that you're living a blameless life. Yes. They can do. Correct, yes. For a householder, you're asking the question, how far can a householder practice this? There are many things which a householder can do. Certainly, you can abandon killing of living beings and put aside rods and weapons. You can apply compassion to all beings. You can make sure that you take what's only given and expect what's given, don't ask for more. And if you're not celibate, at least be chaste. In other words, only have your one partner at a time and be very sensitive to them. And of course, all the speech rules, of course, anybody can and even should practice those. Always being trustworthy and reliable. Not sort of using your speech to divide people in the community, but trying to unite them. If you see there's a difficulty or a problem, you try and speak to both of them and find a middle ground and reconcile, be a mediator. And when you do have to tell somebody off, you don't use harsh speech, but use actually kind speech. And of course, you don't speak too much. And as best as you can, abstain from injuring seeds and plants, you know, environmentally, just you can limit your injury of the natural world. Don't eat too much. And you can certainly reduce the amount of time you spend watching movies and TV and stuff to have more time for meditation if you wish. You don't have to really go around smartening yourself up with designer clothes or with jewelry. And you can use simple furnishings. Abstaining from accepting gold and money, you can't do that as a householder. You've got to sort of get money, go to the shops and buy and sell things. But you can certainly sort of have fewer possessions, which is what we're trying to do. So you can simplify your life, not to the same extent, obviously, as a monk can do, by this full-on celibacy and also not having any money. But you can go a long way. And the further you go, the more that you will experience that sort of blameless happiness, which is also a happiness of simplicity. And even though you can't just be content with robes and a bowl, when you go overseas, you have to take a suitcase. At least it can be one suitcase instead of two. So you can sort of lessen possessions. And thereby, you feel much lighter. It's not really that case, because when you're saying it's about the money for a householder, I just remember that Anathapindika, and he was just a very, very wealthy man, and a great disciple of the Buddha. So there, the Buddha never sort of criticized him for being wealthy. And he said, as long as the wealth was rightly gained, not through oppressing people or exploiting people, or through cheating, as long as it was rightly gained, he said, fine, we'll make good use of it. But, as you would know from your experience of the world, that people who do have the karma to make lots of money have a lot of burden on them. And just the average Joe, the average income level, is usually the best. And as I mentioned here before, I think the US study, and it was repeated for Australia, that if an individual earns more than $50,000 a year, they have less happiness. Less than 50,000 is also less happiness as a householder. So there's like an income there which is the maximum happiness, and too much is known to cause more problems. So if you are earning more than 50,000 and you don't want to follow my suggestion of putting the difference in the donation box, you can actually just cut down on the amount of work you do. So you have more free time, but you still have enough income just to survive. And in a simple, comfortable way. And they work only a few days a week. Anyway, this is actually what we're doing here, going through, is what is actually called the gradual training, because this is repeated many times in many suttas. The problem is that because of the amount of information in all these suttas here, even though this is repeated many, many times, it will be abbreviated later on. And when you abbreviate it in a book like this for saving on printing costs, sometimes you miss its importance. So how many times this is repeated is quite considerable. So you know this is a core teaching of Buddhism, this gradual training. And now after the bliss that is blameless, now we get to what we call sense restraint. Now remember, this is all about understanding. Is this fellow a Buddha or is he not a Buddha? Now can you actually know that this is a teaching you're going to follow, or this is a teaching which is really worthwhile? How can you know that these guys are the real thing? On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil or rather unskillful and unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. So he practices a way of restraint. He guards the eye faculty, undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. What that really means, for example, you're a guy, you see a beautiful girl. What do we mean by a beautiful girl? There'll be some part of her which is the most beautiful part. For example, she may have just beautiful hair. And that's what you'll go and look at. You're the part of her which is going to incite, that particular feeling of lust or romance or desire. And people like that feeling of excitement, so that as a psychologist, when you see someone you really want to be excited, you straight away go to that part of that person which really excites you the most. So actually go to some part of them. And that's like, as a monk, we were trained a long time ago, not just to go to the most delightful part of that object, but just go to the other parts as well. So you may have heard me here before saying that how I trained myself when I was a young monk, if I saw a beautiful girl come into the monastery, I'd actually look for her pimples. And I always see a pimple there somewhere. And it was a pimple which was just enough to sort of say, that's not perfect. So I was looking at not just one detail, look at the detail which balanced the beauty part of it. And that meant that she was just a girl, not some sort of sex object. So say with the ear faculty, on hearing a sound with the ear, we don't grasp at its signs and features, because when somebody is talking, you know, again, as a psychologist, you know you can actually get some part of what they say. You know, just their tone of the voice, and just miss everything else. And sometimes when people are looking to get upset, they're just waiting for you to say something wrong, and they grab onto that just to justify their ill will. So again, it's like grabbing on some sign, some feature, some part of the whole, which will give you the ill will. When it says covetousness and grief, as you've heard me mention before, that covetousness and grief also represent the first two hindrances of desire and ill will. It doesn't mean grief in the sense of the feeling you experience when you've lost a loved one through death. That's why that translation is a bit odd. What it really means is like ill will. So if you don't guard the ear faculty, it's easy to get like excited, usually with ill will or sometimes with desire. And it's the same with the nose faculty and the tongue faculty and the body, even cognizing a mind object with the mind. You do not grasp at its signs and features when you start thinking about somebody. And it might be someone you really like. And if you grasp at that part of them which you like, the nice memories, you can get some lust coming up. Or if it's someone you know and it's something they said which you didn't agree with, if you grasp on that rather than grasp on the whole of what they've been saying, again, you can get ill will coming up. So you don't grasp at the part. You know, you just see the whole of it in order to balance your mind so that you're not overcome by states of desire and ill will. And this is actually how we practice the way of restraint of the senses. Now please understand here, by restraining the senses, it doesn't mean you shut your eyes, you shut your ears and nose and mouth, and so you don't see anything. That's not restraint of the senses. The classic story told to me by Ajahn Chah was when he was a young novice, maybe 16 or 17, and a young guy, had a lot of lust, and so he decided for 3 months, whole 3 months of the range retreat, he wouldn't look at a girl at all. He put his eyes straight down on the ground, and he managed to do that. He had such good control. He never saw a girl for 3 whole months. And so for those 3 months of range retreat, he was very, very peaceful. But after his determination was over, he looked up at the first girl he saw, and he was lost. He had a huge rush of lust and romance come up, which is actually what happens. You know, if you over-restrain, you suppress, then again, you don't look, that's not dealing with the problem. That's not restraint. Ajahn Chah called that stupidity, and it ends up creating more lust or more ill will if you use such suppression. But instead, you use more wisdom. You look, but you don't just look at the things which excite you. You look at the other part as well. You see the whole picture. It's not a sex object. It's a woman. It's a man. It's a human being. It's a person. So you see the whole thing rather than the part. And that way you become far more at ease and at peace with things. You're not looking at the world. You're not looking at part of the picture. You're looking at the big picture. And it's a big picture which gives you a sense of peace and ease. So really what you're restraining the sense of the mind picking up part of the picture to support or encourage, you know, its desire or ill will. Is that making sense there?
Something that sets you up.
Okay. It's in the preliminary stage before you can do sense restraint. Please remember when you're practicing like restraint through virtuous conduct, you know, things like not harming anybody, not sort of speaking gossip or not being malicious with your speech, you're already restraining, you know, your mind. So many of the defilements, especially of ill will and desire, already being sort of put a boundary around them. Now you just take that boundary a little bit closer in with sense restraint. But it's not putting that boundary around the mind with force, it's putting it around it with some wisdom. So it's, sense restraint is not shutting the eyes. It's seeing, but seeing with some wisdom. So not grasping just one part and not the other part. And why we do that? It's, you know, obvious that we look at somebody because we're already wanted to be excited. We're looking for someone to turn us on. Or when you're in a really bad mood, you're out there looking for something to criticize, something to put down. So you can see that tendency is already in you, you know, before you use the senses. And what you actually see, what you hear, tends to reinforce that tendency. Someone's in a really bad mood. You know, and whatever you say, Chris, you know, you speak too much. Look at that shirt you're wearing. This is a crazy shirt. If I'm in a bad mood, anything, you can pick on anything. And of course it feels right. You are justified. But that nice and kind part of you, I just won't be able to see that. I'm just picking up some details to reinforce the fact I'm in a bad mood. When you're in a really good mood, things are going very well today. Say, oh, that's a lovely shirt you've got on. And it's really nice that someone asked questions during the talk. So whatever it is, when you're in a good mood, of course you can pick up on the nice things, which is also wrong. You pick up on the whole thing. You're not a good guy, you're not a bad guy, you're just a guy. So that way you don't get sort of hot, you don't get ill will, you don't get any of these things which agitate the mind over much. But the preparation, yeah, you can say there's a preparation there in practicing virtue, practicing precepts. To be balanced, yes. Balanced, fair, seeing a bigger picture. Be aware of it, deal with it, but to understand that the reason why you get attracted there, because you only see part of it. Even like the ice cream, which you... I've often noticed that for me as a monk, ice creams always feel or look more delicious in the afternoon when I can't have them. Many, 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 many times there's an ice cream on offer at the tables and I just don't take it. But then sometimes we go past an ice cream van in the afternoon and I think, wow, it'd be really nice to have an ice cream. And sometimes you look into this and where is that desire coming from? So you investigate. No, when you see a beautiful girl, what actually do you want? And why is that girl attractive? And what part of it is attractive? So you don't pick up, this is what it means, picking up the signs and the features. There's only certain signs and certain features which are productive of like desire. There's certain signs and features which are productive of ill will. And our job is actually to know those signs which create these lusts, or those signs which create your will, and you get sort of a sense of restraint to know those signs. If you really want to get lustful, that's what you want to do, fine. You know actually how it works, what to look for. But if you want to be peaceful, you know, not to look at, you know, her breasts or her hair or her bottom or something, but look for her toes or something. Or something else which is balances. So the lust. Get a broader picture. Does that make sense? Absolutely, yeah. Mindfulness, yeah, but also a will as well, wanting to do that. You know, wanting to be at peace. Because a lot of times people don't really want to be at peace. They want to be excited, they want to be aroused. But if you want to be at peace, this is what you can do. Restraining. And he said, you get a payback there. You get a bliss that is unsullied. It's a happiness which is not sort of born of craving and desire. And it's unsullied, it's unmarked by the delight and ill will. And now we have even more awareness, which you were talking about. When you have that degree of restraint, then of course you can have some full awareness. Actually, when it says full awareness here, it's, again, sometimes these translations are not that accurate. Sometimes they're too traditional. The word is sampajanya. And if you know a little bit of Pali, sam means with, pajanya means the same word as panya. It means like with knowledge, with understanding. So this section 16 is not actually full awareness, but full understanding. The idea of awareness being that you know what you're doing and why you're doing it. Especially why you're doing it. So you act in full knowledge when going forward and returning. Full knowledge when looking ahead and looking away. You know what you're doing this for. What's the purpose of it? You act in full knowledge when flexing, extending your limbs. You act in full knowledge when wearing your robes, carrying your outer robe and bowl. Act in full knowledge when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. There's a different word in Pali when you eat the staple food like rice or bread and potatoes, and another word for when you eat the curries or the anything else. There's different words for the two different types of eating. You act in full knowledge when defecating and urinating. Full knowledge when walking, standing, sitting, asleep, awake, talking and keeping silent. And just as a technical point here, you notice I changed the translation here, falling asleep and waking up. The Pali does not mean that. The Pali is very clear, it means being asleep or being awake. The problem is that the translator, and you've got to be very careful when you translate, because you have to translate what's actually there, rather than what you think should be there. Because when you have like idea of awareness, how can you be aware while asleep? So the translator, the original translator, Venwayana Tiloka, a great monk, but he said, how can you be aware when asleep? Impossible. So he said it must mean falling asleep or waking up. But that is actually a wrong translation. You act with full knowledge about sleeping, full knowledge about being awake. In other words, what's the purpose of sleeping? What are you doing it for? So you don't just sleep excessively as an escape from the world. You know, you sleep to rest the body, to rest the mind. You sleep well. So now you actually know what it means by the full knowledge, with wisdom, sleeping just the right amount, not too little, not too much. And so they call this possessing the aggregate of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and this noble mindfulness and full awareness. So this is like almost a preliminary like restraining and training. The monk or nun resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. So the monks were supposed to be, nuns, supposed to be living in the forest, in secluded places. We weren't meant to live in the middle of the town. I know some people say, oh, you can meditate just as well in a marketplace. When you're enlightened, yes. Or when you're a good meditator, maybe. But, you know, you start off by going to secluded places, which is why we built a retreat center in a secluded place rather than here. So even the lay community yourselves, that you now can a resort to a secluded resting place, to a forest, to a nice jungle thicket in the middle of Serpentine. And so on returning from the alms round after the meal, the monk sits down, folds his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishes mindfulness as a priority we've got before him. Here we go. Abandoning covetous for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetous. He purifies his mind from covetous. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, Mindful and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. You purify your mind from doubt. You all know those are the five hindrances, the Panchanivarana. And you can see the first hindrance there, covetousness. So, very often, the five hindrances begin, instead of with karma chanda, sensory desire, with covetousness for the world. Exactly as in Satipatthana Sutta. So, when it says it's having abandoned covetousness for the world and grief, what that really means is the abandoning the first hindrance, and grief means the second hindrance. And here we have an example. The first hindrance is covetous from the world, which means sensory desire. But that gives some more examples, more deeper examples of what these five hindrances are. Abandoning ill will, you're compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, including yourself. So that hindrance is not just having a sort of a mind which is nothing. You actually develop compassion and kindness. So when that hindrance is gone, compassion takes its place. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you're free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light. You've got enough energy in the mind. And you've often heard me say, when the mind is very energetic, that's usually when you see nimittas. And then you're mindful and fully aware when you perceive that light. So I know that sometimes people say, oh, you shouldn't worry about that light, you get attached, you can see he's supposed to do that. He's supposed to be percipient of light. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. So you can understand what restlessness is and what peace is. Which is why to abandon that hindrance, you often hear me say, to make peace, develop peace. And thereby you're abandoning that hindrance. And abandoning doubt, the last of the five hindrances, you abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. You purify your mind from doubt. So how do you know what wholesome states are? It's almost only by sort of getting to these deep states of mind or understanding such things as the blameless happiness or the unsullied happiness. Through experience you overcome the doubt. So those are bad in the five hindrances. Sorry? It has to be the main way of overcoming doubt, because no matter how much faith, how much you believe, there'll always be an element of doubt there. Even again, the born-again Christians or the fanatical Muslims, they still have doubt, but the doubt is heavily suppressed. But the doubt is still there, and it can arise at any time. Which is why even like suicide bombers sometimes give themselves up to the authorities, because doubt comes into their mind. So having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, you enter upon the abiding in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement of the mind onto the object in keeping with the object, with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This is the first jhana. Again, I have changed the translation over here, because there is no thought in a jhana. This word vitaka vichara, and interestingly, for those who go into depth with their understanding of the Buddha's teachings, many monks are now comparing these Pali suttas with the equivalent in Chinese. And in the Chinese versions, they call the Agama, they use a different translation for the Pali words vitaka vichara in the jhana, and vitaka vichara outside of the jhana. Because vitaka vichara outside of jhana does mean thinking and pondering, if you like. But inside a jhana, it's much subtle, it's pre-verbal, just the mind moving onto the object and holding it. And the Chinese translators obviously knew that, and so they used the different Chinese characters for the same words. If those words were used outside of jhanas, there's one set of Chinese characters. In jhanas, a different set of characters. So even they realize that it means different things in different contexts. And of course, where it says the first jhana, secluded from sensual pleasures, it means secluded from the five senses, not just the pleasure. Again, that's a mistaken translation. It's vivicha kamehi. If it said vivicha kama sukehi, fair enough. But it means secluded from the five senses. Secluded from unwholesome states, that actually means the five hindrances. You enter upon the abode in the first jhana, accompanied by a movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Seclusion from what? It's actually from the seclusion from the five senses. So happiness when you don't have to be concerned and bothered with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and also physical touch. That's where the pleasure comes from. Pause. Any questions there? But actually, this is my favorite line now in the sutta. This Brahmin is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. Just like the elephant in the first simile, they see the footprint, the scrapings, and the marks, but they haven't seen the elephant yet, so they're not really sure. But nevertheless, it's a footprint of the Tathagata, of the Buddha. And it's quoting that, I tell Thai people, because it's supposed to be a footprint of the Buddha at Prabhutabhat and a couple of other places in Thailand, and it's a footprint of the Buddha in Siripada, in the Adam's Peak in Sri Lanka. But you don't need to climb up that mountain to see the real Buddha's footprint, because you can see from this sutta, the first Buddha's footprint is jhana, first jhana. So you can actually go and worship the Buddha's footprint by just developing your meditation and getting to first jhana. And that is a footprint of the Buddha. And again, with the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, the monk or the nun or the layperson enters upon and abides in a second jhana, which has the self-confidence. In other words, you are just at peace, you're confident with the object, you don't need to hold anymore. And the singleness of mind, this is where the first experience of non-duality comes in, without the movement of the mind, and the rapture and pleasure born of stillness. So because the mind is not moving anymore, it's samadhi, it's still. This is the piti sukha born of samadhi. This too, Brahmin, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Something scraped by the Buddha, marked by the Buddha, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. Again, with the fading away as well as the rapture part of the happiness, a monk abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure, not with the body. Feeling with the body is the idiom in Pali, which means experiencing it for yourself. So still experiencing for himself that pleasure or herself. You enter upon abide in the third jhana, on the account of which noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding who is equanimous and mindful. The body has been well left behind a long time ago. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Buddha. Something marked by the Buddha, something scraped by the Buddha, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, Dharma well proclaimed, and the Sangha is practicing the good way. And again, with the abandoning of the pleasure and pain and the previous disappearance of joy and grief, one enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. They always pause there, because this is the ultimate of mindfulness. People who say when you're in jhana it's like a trance, you're not mindful, I always quote this. This is the purity of mindfulness. This too is called a footprint of the Tathagata, a scraping of the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But the noble disciple has not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha is practicing the good way, but still a footprint. And now we get the psychic powers, but not sort of going through the air. These are the first of what's called the three knowledges or the three insights. When the still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. I like the word malleable or wieldy. Many of you may know when you get into deep enough states of meditation, you can feel you can do things. It's got energy. And you just give it a suggestion and it follows it. This is actually what it feels like to have deep meditation or to come out of deep meditation. So at that stage, coming out of the meditation, you direct it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. You know how I teach that? To ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And earlier, please. So you recollect your manifold past lives. 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100,000 births, many eons of world contractions and eons of world expansion, or eons of contraction and expansion straight away. You can see that this is repeated many times. We don't say the world was created once. So there's many, don't even say creation, like world expansions and contractions, eons of existence. And thus, with their aspects and particulars, you recollect your many past lives. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, even when you can recollect your past lives. When the still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. You understand how beings pass on according to their karma. That's the actions there, thus. Thus, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away, reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and understands how beings pass on according to karma. So this is where you understand the law of karma. So you understand the law of rebirth, and you understand how rebirth happens, you know, karma, and how it sends people to different realms, and different things happen to you in different realms. So by understanding your past lives, you get the data to get a good understanding of the law of karma. But this too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Buddha, something scraped by the Buddha, something marked by the Buddha, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. And you're getting pretty close, but it's still not enough to be absolutely sure the Buddha really was the One. When your mind, concentrated mind is thus, or the still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, remember, this is through the jhanas. You direct it to knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the outflowings. You understand as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the outflowings, the origin of the outflowings, the cessation of the outflowings. This is the way leading to the cessation of the outflowings. So you understand as it actually is the Four Noble Truths. This too, Brahmin, is called a footprint of the Buddha, something scraped by the Buddha, something marked by the Buddha. Now, it's a nice, interesting statement here, but a noble disciple still has not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. Rather, he is in the process of coming to this conclusion. So what's happening here, even when you've seen the Four Noble Truths, they call that the attainment of stream winning. Seen the Dhamma, understood the Dhamma, understood the problem. And it's once that Dhamma has been seen and understood, you're in the process of coming to the conclusion. In other words, once you see what the problem is, clear, without shadow of doubt, it's only a matter of time. When? The causes are abandoned. The causes for future life, for future rebirth. When you know and see thus, your mind soon, I'm going to add here, soon becomes liberated from the outflowing of sensual desire, from the outflow of being, and from the outflowing of ignorance. Or you might say the outflowing due to the idea of being and the idea of ignorance. Once the Dhamma is seen, it's only a matter of time when, what's the point of sensory desire? Understanding the Dhamma, there's no more attachment to wanting to exist. The only reason why we want to be is because we think there's something in there which is. Having seen anatta, there's no more attachment to being, to existing, and to repeating yourself in another life. And sensual desire, when you really understand suffering, the five senses are seen as completely suffering, so why do you want to have any sensory desire? When it is having seen that, eventually your mind becomes liberated from these taints. When the mind is liberated, there comes a knowledge. It is liberated. And the liberation of the mind from those taints, that is the time when one is an arahat. That is the time you understand that birth is destroyed, rebirth is destroyed. Holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So this is regarding the attainment of arahat, full enlightenment. So you see, the stream winning comes first with understanding the problem, the Four Noble Truths, understanding the way out. The origin of suffering is craving. The end of suffering is letting go of that craving, abandoning it. And the path is the Eightfold Path. So you follow that path and then your mind becomes liberated. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Buddha, something marked by the Buddha. It is at this point the noble disciple has come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. And it is at this point, Brahman, that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in detail. Here you've actually seen sort of the Buddha. You are the same as a Buddha, fully enlightened, which is why at this point your experience is one and the same with a Buddha, an arahat, fully enlightened. So only then, through such personal experience, could you actually be saying here, yes, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Because you know what fully enlightened actually is. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, because you practice that Dhamma. And the Sangha is practicing the good way, because that's the way you practiced. You know it leads to the end. So that's a very high high bar to cross or to jump over. And he's saying that's the only real way that you can be totally sure that that's a real bull elephant, by experiencing what the Buddha experienced. And at the very least, experiencing some of the jhanas, what the Buddha experienced, because that's like a footprint. You're getting close. And now if you don't see any of those footprints, or if the elephant doesn't leave such footprints, it can't be a bull elephant. So if the teacher or the guru doesn't have the jhanas, not even any footprint there, of course, that can't be sort of the real thing. So these are footprints. And how you come to full understanding that, yeah, this is actually a Buddha. Buddha has arrived in the world. When this was said, the Brahmin Janasoni said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms that stand it. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Standard passage, when somebody got inspired and they became a disciple, they went for the three refuges. And I'll point out there, the third refuge is a Sangha of monks. It's a monastic Sangha. Sometimes that third refuge is the Sangha of bhikkhunis. But that's what the third refuge actually means. And if you look through the whole of the Tripitaka, I think in the Chinese it's the same. So this hasn't been just changed by the Theravada monks. The three refuges are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the monastic Sangha. These are the three refuges. And when a person goes for refuge, very often, because they've been so inspired, they go for refuge for life. So they don't just come up and every poya day or one prayer or every waysak day take the three refuges. They do it once in their life and stay with it for the rest of their life. So when we give the three refuges and the five precepts so many times, that's really a bit of a ceremony. But traditionally, you'd give it once and they keep it for once. In the same way, I sometimes give a simile of like when you get married. How many times do you get married to your wife? You only do one ceremony, you know, once in your lifetime. You don't sort of repeat it on every anniversary and, go and do the same ceremony again in front of a priest. You do it once and keep it, hopefully, unless you get divorced or something. But you don't keep on doing it every week. The same way the five precepts of going for refuge really should be just done once, full on, rather than just keep on doing it and relegating this wonderful asseveration of faith into just a mere ceremony. So that's the simile of the elephant's footprint, which goes through the gradual training all the way to enlightenment, very standard teaching. Obviously mentions the jhanas, starting off with the virtuous conduct, self-restraint, and being very knowledgeable and aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. Overcoming the five hindrances, attaining the jhana as a natural result of the overcoming of the five hindrances, developing such things as recollection of past lives, and with that, the understanding of the law of karma, seeing the big picture of what suffering truly is, not just in this life, but a whole heap of lives, understanding the Four Noble Truths, the real problem of existence, and then becoming the stream winner, and from the stream winner, eventually becoming the Arahat. Each one you're getting closer and closer to seeing the Buddha and understanding what the Buddha is. So even as a stream winner, they say the stream winner in other suttas has full confidence, unshakable confidence, that the Buddha is enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed, the Blessed One, the Sangha, practicing the good way. So actually that little phrase there is a little bit of anomaly. Because most of the time they say a stream winner, if you've seen the Four Noble Truths, you have unshakable confidence, yeah, the Buddha is enlightened. But here the Buddha's making the point that that's confidence, but real 100% certainty is only attained when you actually achieve the same as what the Buddha achieved, the full enlightenment. Now that was the first sermon which Mahinda gave to King Dewanampiyatisa? In Sri Lanka. And I always reflect, why? Why was that the teaching which this great monk chose as the first teaching to give? Out of all the other suttas which he could have given, why did he choose this one? And I think it was, this is my own, no one actually really knows, but my own reflections are, to be able to convey the path, the gradual training, to the king and all the people with him, that this is not just a belief system, this is something to be done, and the profundity of that path, and the fact it seems so easy at the beginning. Yeah, we can all practice that virtue, we can all be simple, we can all do sense restraint. Yeah, we can, we understand these five hindrances. And then to actually to see, you go seamlessly from this into such things as jhanas. It's almost just give you confidence. Yeah, it can be done because all the preliminaries can be achieved. You know, from those jhanas, yeah, you can actually understand and remember past lives and understanding karma and penetrate the Four Noble Truths. It makes the practice both profound but also attainable, which is the most important thing to try and do. So it is a deep path, a very profound path, but you can do it. So I think that's one of the reasons why Mahinda gave this teaching. but also actually to arouse faith and say, well, look, you know, I may have flown through the air, you know, I may be this great wise arahant, but you know, can never really be sure of me until you practice this thing for yourself and achieve, you know, what I've achieved. And that's the only way you can really have faith. I'm sure in Sri Lanka at that time, as in today, there are many, many teachers, gurus, not just of different religions, but even within Buddhism, all proclaiming that their way is the best and this is the only way, or whatever they proclaim. And you can never be absolutely sure. But what you can do is to know that there is a path. There's a path to be able to see for yourself. And it's not just a path of just thinking. It's this whole path of training. And it is true that the more you practice this path, the more your faith grows. As you do realize, yeah, the five precepts, they do work. You do feel much better as a result. You do have such a thing like, you know, the blameless happiness. And if you practice sense restraint and live more simply, you do have more freedom and happiness. And you can meditate, you can get deep. And people do get into jhanas, even lay people get into jhanas. It can be done. And that gives you the encouragement and the faith. Yeah, this Buddha actually was maybe enlightened. And the Dharma is well proclaimed. And the Sangha, you know, practice in forests and meditate, you know, and keep their precepts, are practicing the good way. And that gives you increase in faith. As you get closer to the goal, you get closer to seeing the elephant and understand, yes, that's what the Buddha is. The more you practice, the deeper the faith gets. And usually, as I said, the Tirumala Streamina, when I've seen the Four Noble Truths, that's where the faith gets unshakable, but fully certain of the attainment of full enlightenment. Okay, any questions or comments on that? That's a very good question. I don't really think so. I can infer past lives, but it obviously helps. Sorry? There is a difference. It's fascinating. I'll tell you some of the little tricks, because in some of the Buddhist texts, there's always a problem, because we have, for monks and nuns, we have this very strong rule. It's called the fourth parajika. And if any monk or nun claims to be, say, a stream winner, if they're lying, actually they're out. It's a disrobable offence. If they deliberately claim to be what they're not, that's such a serious offence that you have to leave the monkhood or the nunhood. So because of that, you can actually ask, why did the Buddha say that? Because it's so easy to overestimate. So in order to find out, you know, if a person says they're a stream winner or arahat or something, you know, we have to actually question them. And it's almost like a bit of a secret teaching, but, you know, I don't like secret teachings, I'll let you know. You actually ask a person, if they say they're a stream winner, you say, when? What time? Where? What was going on? What did you see? Because stream winning is an event. It's a time when it happens. It's not something which sort of gradually grows on you. It's something which, that's the time you see the Dhamma. So that's one of the questions. It has to be an event, not just a process. And that usually says, I didn't really have that big bang. So it has to be like a big bang experience. That's number one. And it's also, it does mean that you cannot actually understand what the Dhamma really is. And also you know there's no self. There's no doubt about that anymore. So you know that five senses and even the mind are suffering. No doubt about that anymore. The biggest one is anatta, non-self. It's amazing just how many even meditators and teachers still think, yeah, well, what the Buddha meant by anatta, it's only a strategy, it's not, you know, a real thing, you know. And there is actually sort of maybe, you know, the I'm not a self, but there's some sort of cosmic self of which I'm a part. I mean, the Buddha was saying, no way, nowhere, anywhere, no form of consciousness is permanent, any cosmic consciousness. So those are the sort of things you can actually test out to find if a person really understands the Dhamma. Sometimes the anatta doctrine is one of the easiest ones to test a person out. I'm letting into too many tricks. Because when you know the exam, sometimes you can fudge the exam when you know what the right answers are. You know, I remember this. This is just an interesting anecdote. There's this one guy who came to our monastery a long time ago. I don't know if any of you remember him. He was actually a street kid. But he came to our monastery because we're very open. And he wanted to do the right thing. And he was going around sort of saying that he was a really good meditator. He was meditating for many hours. He even actually came to me and he started describing his meditation experiences. And you know, these were really deep experiences he was having. And I think Ajahnayana was there at the time, and Ajahnayana was talking to him a lot and saying, this is an amazing person. He's really getting somewhere. And all these experiences, they were, as he described them, they were just dinky-dye jhanas. And then one of the other Anagarikas was walking by several times his room in the guest block, and he was sleeping all day. He's actually completely making them up. But he was one of the most convincing and well-researched liars I'd ever come across. Because what he'd done, he'd read all the books, and he was brilliant. He knew all the language, and he just described it perfectly. And I was really impressed. And I said, you know, you're wasting your time in a monastery, because you've got to be honest in a monastery, but you make a really good politician. That's just the way I said that to him. But he had a lot of us monks fooled for a while, because the way he said things, because, you know, he knew, he'd been reading all the books, and he was very, very sharp. And when I actually confronted him afterwards, he said, this is the only way I've learned how to survive out in the streets, by learning what people want and tell them exactly what they want to hear. And, you know, because of his upbringing there, he was very, very strong on being able to convince others what they want to hear. And he did that at our monastery, and it was amazing. So in one sense, you know, he was a liar, but he was incredibly, one of the best liars I've ever seen. So you can sort of fool people sometimes. That's why you don't want to give up too much information about what these things are. So when it happens, we can actually give you a good test. And so you don't know all the answers. Any other questions? Yeah. Indeed, yeah. Because sometimes I understand your point with so much books and talks about karma, because sometimes some priests, monks, nuns, but acting more like priests, they use karma just to induce fear in people. So it's just like, you know, the old priests who say, if you don't come to church every Sunday, you'll go to hell. I'll describe what hell is. I had this vision this morning from Jesus. This is what hell is. And I've seen your father down there because they went to the Buddhist temple. I've seen your auntie because she had a Buddha statue in her house. And they were being burnt and flayed alive. And it's very easy for unscrupulous people to arouse fear in people. And sometimes that you'd be very careful not to use the law of karma as a fear-inducing. Apparently, I was being told by someone recently that there's a temple in Thailand, and they got these amazing, what was it in Sri Lanka? They're saying in the south of Sri Lanka, they got these amazing pictures of hell. And it's terrifying. You know, it's, they've used a bit of modern technology. It's almost like a hell theme park. And you go in there and say, this is what happens if you don't keep your five precepts. This is what happens if you don't go to temple on Poya Day. And it's, you're using like karma as fear as a mechanism of control. And that's something which is just really off. So if you see any books like that, karma, and say, if you do this thing, this is what happens to you, then that's not how karma works. Karma is far more subtle than that. It's more nuanced. So that's why if you see books which use the law of karma to instill fear in people, that's not Buddhism. I prefer that. At least you're encouraging people for, with like happiness, a positive encouragement. It's not through fear. It's almost like a bit of reward. But even that, because sometimes people do, they come to the temple and they give some food and they ask for some holy water because they've got an exam tomorrow. And they get very upset when they fail their exam and they think that the monk's chanting is no good or the holy water's not. And they never come here again. They go to the next temple up the road. And if they happen to pass their exam, they say, oh, that temple up the road, that's really good. Because you can pass your exams when you get their holy water, but Ajahn Brahm's holy water is no good. And that's sort of silly stuff. So if it's really good karma, to actually understand karma, it's your intention is karma. It's not so much what you do, but why you do it. Does that answer the question, Cheng, sort of? Yeah, it's a big question. But even the Buddha said that only the Buddhas can actually fully understand the law of karma. It's one of those imponderables, which are just so profound and so deep, that even the great arahats, they don't fully understand karma. When the Buddha said that, that's an amazing saying. He was just being very honest. It's a very subtle thing to understand. Okay, but it is your karma to not be able to ask any more questions. Because it's now 4:30 and people have got to go and do what they need to do. So thank you for listening to today's sutta. Again, done in gratitude of my visit to Sri Lanka, the lesser simile of the elephant's footprint. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do.
Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namassami.